Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, another hour of open forum with Jimmy Akin here as our guest. Your calls welcome, 888-31-TRUTH. And about, carry the two, 1 million people on the line right now. So right back to the phones we go. Jimmy, thanks for coming back for another hour.
My pleasure.
Looking forward to the Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. I wonder what this is. Could it be a military craft of some sort? Is that a possibility? Or no?
That's one of the things that they asked in the wake of the experience.
All right. Now, I see what you're saying. I got to tune in to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on my own.
Well, think about it this way. If they had found that it was a military craft.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a
good
point.
Would this still be a mystery?
No, it would not. All right. Going to the phones. John in Pennsylvania, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. I can only imagine, John, how many campaign ads are on TV in Pennsylvania right now. Must be insane.
Definitely, but that's why I don't watch TV.
Smart move, man. What do you do?
I am I'm a history teacher.
Oh, all right. Well, we're glad to have you here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Okay, well, I've got two questions. One's for you, Cy, and one's for Jimmy. So my one for you is a quick one. Just how do I get a question in for the weird questions with Jimmy days
no.
or whatever. Is there an email for that or something?
Well,
and
okay.
You
want
to, go ahead. Yeah,
I was just going to say that's not a question for me. That's a question for Jimmy because he'll tell you.
Well,
how to do it.
you can either email me directly at one of my numerous email addresses, or you could email radio@catholic.com and they will forward it to me. And just make sure it's flagged in the subject line as weird question so I know the rubric to look at it under.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Okay, so then my real question is, I do martial arts, mm-hmm. and to try and, you know, keep myself fit and, you know, for practice of the martial arts, I do a practice called Qigong, which mm-hmm. is I stand in certain positions, the Chinese practice. There's different types of Qigong, but the one I do, I just stand in different positions, and I don't think anything, I just stand in those positions for a certain amount of time. And then also, mm-hmm. I do yoga. I'm at home. I do the stretching, a series of stretches to help keep my body limber. And for me, I've always thought that there's no problem with this, you know, because I'm not doing it for spiritual reasons or anything. And I think you can get, you know, you can help from something even if you don't agree with, like, you know, chiropractic. The guy who started chiropractic was a believer in spiritualism, and he thought his thing was, you know, related to mesmerism and all this stuff. But actually, you can still get relief from it, or you can use it practically. So, but my thing is that I've had a lot of people asking me, you know, predominantly Protestants saying, well, you know, as a Christian, you shouldn't be doing those things. You shouldn't do yoga or these kind of exercises because they're not Christian. So I'd like to hear your opinion. If you could walk me through the logic of where's the cutoff of what's licit and not licit for a Catholic.
In these practices, in your participation in these practices, are you doing them alone or are you doing them in a group setting?
By myself.
Okay, so that leaves out any question of that means we don't have to deal with any question of what is the impact on other people by you doing them since you're doing them by yourself. Second question: are you appealing to any spirits, whether they're gods or angels or demons or departed human spirits or nature spirits? Are you appealing to any spirits in your practice of these things?
No.
Okay. Are you attempting to manipulate energies in your body, meaning energies of some kind of spiritual nature?
No.
Okay. So for you, these are just physical motions that you're using to relax or balance or something like that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So you are not doing anything religious here, and therefore you are not doing anything that is contrary to the Christian religion. For historical reasons, you may refer to these practices as Qigong or yoga, but fundamentally, you're not doing anything. You're not getting any religious benefit out of this, are you?
No.
Okay, so you're not doing anything religious here. You're just doing some exercises. And as a result, you are not doing anything contrary to the Catholic understanding of the Christian faith. And consequently, if someone asks you about these, you can just tell them, look, this isn't religious at all to me. I'm just doing exercises. And so I'm not doing any kind of faith practice here at all.
Perfect.
All right. Very good.
Great. Thank you so much.
All right. Appreciate back to the history teacher.
Yep.
All right. Look forward to your weird question.
All right. Thanks so much.
Bye, John. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Let me see where we're going next. Oh, what did I do? I'm looking at the wrong sheet. I apologize. Jimmy, who's next? Can you tell me who's next? I have a little problem here with my internet.
Dana. On line two.
All right, Dana on line two. Thanks for waiting, Dana. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy. Dana?
Thank you. Hey,
go ahead.
I hope that you can hear me.
Yep.
Yes, so I am a skeptic. I don't believe Jesus is divine. Just full disclosure on that, which really affects the way I look at the gospel stories. But my question is, John chapter 2, verse 10, it appears that the people at the wedding in Canaan, when Jesus' miracle of turning water into wine, by the comments of the banquet master, that they had some level of alcohol impairment. Mm-hmm. At least to the point where they couldn't necessarily tell the difference between a really good quality wine or a cheaper wine, depending on how you want to, what lens you want to look through this story through. But I was wondering, what Jimmy's comments were about, was Jesus being irresponsible when he turned water into wine, or is this really a miracle as it's portrayed to be, in him showing his divinity in this way?
Well, it is a miracle, and he is showing his supernatural power from God. In terms of the responsibility of that, I guess there are a few things to say. The first one is the sin of drunkenness is not any alcohol consumption, and it's not just any level of alcohol impairment either. If you look at, for example, at St. Thomas Aquinas's treatment of this, he explains that the sin of drunkenness or intoxication is when you consume so much that you lose your moral faculties and thus become open to committing immoral acts, in other words. So that's the fundamental essence of the sin of drunkenness. If you have consumed alcohol, and even if you're experiencing some effects of alcohol, but you haven't lost your moral faculties, then you're not committing the sin of drunkenness. You are, in Aquinas's words, imperfectly drunk rather than perfectly drunk. And so all we know from the text is that at least most of the people, or many of the people at the wedding at Cana, had drunk enough that they had some taste discernment impairment, but that doesn't mean they had lost their moral faculties and were willing to go do flagrantly immoral things. So by continuing to facilitate the party, Jesus wouldn't be doing anything that was immoral. He wasn't behaving irresponsibly in that way. Furthermore, I think this illustrates something else, because there is a very good chance that some of the people at the wedding had drunk too much, more than they should have. And it is back up one step from that. Our culture has a kind of puritanical nature that is suspicious at times of pleasures, and we don't want to let modern puritanical judgments about situations like this govern our reading of scripture passages. We need to recognize that our culture was so crazy that in the early 20th century, they tried to ban drinking alcohol outright for everybody in the United States. That's how crazy our culture is. And that experience was known as Prohibition. It happened in the 1920s, and it was so disastrous, they ended it by the 1930s. And so, but nevertheless, we come from a culture where that was possible, where you could pass a constitutional amendment to ban alcohol consumption for everyone. And so we have a culture that has a big problem with appreciating the role of the proper use of alcohol. And there are still lingering effects of that today. But it is quite possible and even likely that some of the people at this wedding got plastered and they were drinking more than they should have. And by making more wine for the people at this party to use, some of them would probably go on to either stay drunk or get drunker yet. And yet Jesus did it anyway. And one of the things that that shows us is we can't take responsibility for other people's choices. Now, there are situations where you know what someone's going to do and you that modifies your behavior. You know, you take steps to ensure that they don't do what you foresee. But in principle, you've got a whole bunch of people. They are not all drinking to excess. They are not all plastered out of their minds and willing to, you know, go commit immoral acts. And even if some of them are, you don't let that ruin it for everybody. And so you allow people to have the freedom to make their the choices that they're going to make. And the responsibility for those choices is fundamentally on them, not on you. And so there's an important lesson here, because the kind of puritanical streak in American culture can often lead us as people of conscience to want to take responsibility for others' actions so that we feel that we are doing something wrong if someone else is doing something wrong. And very often that is not the case. There are exceptions, but fundamentally, Jesus did this, and that shows us it was okay for him to do this. And it would be similarly okay for any one of us if we had been at that party. Now, I don't have miraculous powers. I can't turn water into wine. But if I was at that wedding party and someone said, hey, we're out of wine, can you go down to the store and pick up some more? It would be legitimate for me to go down to the store and pick up some more.
Does that work for you, Dana?
Well, I was wondering if I could maybe just push back a little bit on that, and that Jesus is this divine character, and a few people being intoxicated at that wedding could, in fact, ruin it for the entire wedding. Not to mention that, you know,
well,
in
if they were,
we know a lot more about alcohol abuse than they did in ancient times. It would actually, in many states, it's illegal to serve people once they show signs of alcohol impairment. And then there's alcohol addiction. It all kind of starts with alcohol impairment. And this is best case scenario. If you look at the Greek translation, the people are actually drunk. That's what the party master says when you look at the original language. Now, people have, translated Bibles differently. But anyway, we have a different view on this. And I think it's because of your lens of Christianity and my lens of skepticism that we might see different things in these stories.
Yeah, so you laid about six or seven issues on the table right there, and I probably won't be able to remember them all. I would say you're coming from a cultural perspective. I would say number one, we really don't know a huge amount more about alcohol misuse today than we did then. People have been using alcohol for tens of thousands of years, and we have a long human experience with it. In fact, that's one of the reasons that people of European ancestry can tolerate liquor better than people with Native American ancestry, because Europeans have been drinking wine forever. And there has been a microevolution process that has allowed them to process it better. If you're determined to see what Jesus did as immoral in this situation, I can't dissuade you from that. But I would suggest that it's coming from a puritanical perspective, that even though you're a skeptic, you have nevertheless imbibed from our culture. And you look at the logic that you're using, you're saying, well, alcohol abuse starts with alcohol impairment. Well, sure, but that doesn't mean that that just because someone has become impaired, they're going to proceed to chronic abuse. That's what's known as the slippery slope fallacy, that just because someone has achieved a stage that can lead to something really bad doesn't mean that's going to happen. For some people, will it? Sure. But you can shut down any activity you want if you say some people are going to abuse this, therefore the mere fact that some people are going to abuse it is reason to shut it down. That will shut down anything, and that will result in a kind of totalitarian situation where you or, you know, the people of your mindset are making decisions for everybody, like happened in Prohibition. It won't just be limited to alcohol. I mean, frankly, a much bigger problem in our society today than alcohol is obesity. And you already have people who are trying to regulate the size of sodas, and you can end up in a totalitarian situation where you have government prescribed menus that you're not allowed to deviate from and that are not suited to you as an individual. There has to be a role for human freedom here. And even though we recognize that freedom can be abused, that doesn't mean we embrace totalitarianism as a way of avoiding the abuse of freedom. We want to, you know, educate and inform and experiment and figure out how freedom is best used, but we don't want to eliminate freedom just because some people will abuse it.
Dana, I'll have to leave it there. We're kind of late for the break, but I was enjoying the conversation. So we'll take the break and we'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The power of prayer simply means that words have an effect. For example, when a couple says, "I do," it literally changes two people to becoming one in marriage. When you say, "I love you," it changes us and it gives us value. The power of prayer is in the words and in the sentiment, but it's also in the fact that God, who is omnipotent, all-powerful, answers our prayers.
Welcome back. It's Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's our guest. Don't forget, we got everything on sale right now at shop.catholic.com. And maybe you want to consider doing some of your Christmas shopping, because we know that around Christmas, sometimes these shipping issues develop, and you won't have any of those issues if you want to stop on over, do some Christmas shopping, shop.catholic.com. Everything's on sale. Some things 10, some things 25, some things more than 25% off. Shop.catholic.com. It's Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest, Christian in Keyport, New Jersey, watching on YouTube. You are next, Christian. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Si. Hi, Jimmy. It's been a while since I spoke, but thank you so much for having me. So just get to straight to the question. Why does the Western Rite and its liturgical discipline still choose to not confirm and give the Eucharist to infants like the Eastern Catholics and Orthodox? I know there is a historical reason for it that I often top of my head can't recall. I know it was in the Middle Ages. The only reason that I could find is that the Eucharist to children requires that they have sufficient knowledge to really appreciate what they're getting. But Eastern Orthodox friends don't seem to really understand or see it as a legitimate reason for the West that in the modern world today to keep babies and toddlers from being confirmed and receiving the Eucharist. The second part is a little hypothetical.
Stop. Let's deal with that first part, because otherwise, I mean, if people lay out a whole bunch of considerations, I may not remember them all when I'm giving the answer. So let's deal with that first, then you can ask part two. So the reason that the Latin Rite of the Catholic Church does not confirm infants until a later point in life than baptism is because these two sacraments are were originally celebrated in the early church, at least in the typical situation. They were celebrated by the bishop, and he would give essentially both sacraments to a child at the same time. He would baptize the child, and then he would confirm the child. But then the church grew dramatically, and there were so many babies that needed baptizing that you had to make a choice. Either we had to let people other than the bishop do baptism, because there was no way the bishop could baptize every baby in his diocese. And so the principal ordinary celebrant of baptism became the priest. But then you've got a choice of, do you, since we've historically had the sacrament of confirmation celebrated by the bishop, do you want to have priests doing that on an ordinary basis now or not? And the different rites made different choices. In the Latin rite, the choice was made to say, okay, we're going to have priests be the ordinary people who do baptism, but we still want to have confirmation associated with the bishop. So the bishop will be the ordinary minister of confirmation. And in other rites, in Eastern Catholic circles, they made the opposite choice. They said, okay, so we need priests to be the ordinary ministers of baptism. Therefore, priests can also be the ordinary ministers of confirmation. And there's nothing wrong with either one of those positions. There's not a deep theological reason that says you need to make one choice than the other. They're both legitimate choices to make. You can have preferences. Personally, I tend to prefer the Eastern practice, but that's just a preference. It's not something that needs to be that way because of divine revelation, because divine revelation doesn't dictate one solution over the other. When it comes to admission to the Eucharist, yeah, I mean, you already identified the reason for that. The Latin rite chose to wait until the child can appreciate the nature of the Eucharist that they are receiving, that this is really Christ's body. And various Eastern rites, not all of them, but various Eastern rites made the opposite choice. And there's nothing intrinsically wrong with either one. You can have an opinion of which one you like, but neither is definitively correct, and they're both legitimate options, which is why the church allows them both in different situations, in different rites. So that kind of addresses your part one of your question. What's part two?
I think part two is already answered, but I'll just say it anyway. In the case of an emergency, if a baby's in danger of dying and a Roman Catholic priest isn't available for the parents, would it be acceptable for the parents to go to an Eastern Catholic priest to perform the sacrament of confirmation, viaticum, and baptism? Or would that be kind of pushing certain boundaries? Because I know, respectfully, we should be respecting various rites and traditions as Catholics.
Okay, so under the way canon law is presently configured, Eastern Rite Catholic priests are able to administer the sacraments of initiation, so that's baptism, confirmation, and the Eucharist, to their own subjects. And the way subject is construed in Eastern canon law, it doesn't necessarily mean someone who belongs to your rite and lives in your parish territory. It can be a more informal affiliation. You need to have some kind of connection to where, you know, you're this priest's subject. And then, I mean, like, let's say you go to his church regularly, regardless of where you live or what rite you belong to. And then he could administer the sacraments to your child. When it comes to an emergency situation and the child has already been baptized, my memory is that presses against some legal boundaries, but that could, and I think should, be modified in the future. In fact, I think my personal opinion is that Latin Rite canon law should be modified in the future so that dying infants can be confirmed and receive viaticum. But that's what I would have to say. Now, in terms of viaticum, so that is one where you probably could take this is my memory. It's been a while since I've looked at the law on this, but my memory would be that you probably could go to an Eastern Rite priest and get viaticum for your child Even if the child had not previously been initiated into the Eucharist in the Latin Rite and is not of such an age that they can understand the Eucharist. In fact, today, if you're in an Eastern church, like the ones where they give communion via a spoon, and you're carrying a baby, you better turn the baby away unless you want your child to be receive the Eucharist and be initiated on the spot. Because they're not hesitant about giving it to baptized children. The trickier one would be confirmation. And that's one where I think that I hope that the law gets to a point where confirmation will be administered at least in danger of death to children regardless of their age.
Christian, thanks. You can hear the music, so that means we have to take the break, but it'll be a very short break. We'll be right back with more calls for Jimmy. It's open forum. Anybody can call with any question at all for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement, but the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life, but only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whywearepro-life.com.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. A little bit of groovy music for you. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. And I don't want to jinx Sarah, but I think the audio has been perfect so far today. So I think you got a half hour to go, but keep it together. But perfection so far. Max in Utah is next, watching on YouTube. Max, thanks for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I will start by saying I'm holding my infant son, so hopefully he won't make any noise. But
we're pro baby.
Okay. Babies are gonna baby.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. So my question is, so I grew up Mormon, living in Utah, not that uncommon. But I got married Mormon. I did that whole Mormon thing, and then in my process of leaving the Mormon Church, which I have since done, I was divorced. Mm-hmm. And as I have been finding my way to the Catholic Church, I know that that is a kind of a big no-no. And so I wanted to know kind of what I needed to do to kind of get that taken care of. Like, I'm really not even sure, like, how to ask a question. I just want to make sure that, like, if and when I find my way into communion with the church, like, I want to make sure that I'm okay, if that makes sense.
Sure, and that's very commendable. So the church acknowledges that there are legitimate reasons for a couple to have a civil divorce, and so don't think that this is automatically going to be regarded as a big problem. So are you currently remarried or are you planning on getting remarried?
I'm planning to be remarried.
Okay.
My girlfriend and I are planning on it. That's who the mother is to this little boy I'm holding.
Okay. So the church will want to make sure. Now, there are a couple of ways to proceed on this. So the first one, you were a Mormon. You had never been any other kind of, you'd never been baptized in any other group. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. And was the same thing true for your former spouse?
Yeah.
Okay. So the church had done an analysis of this and concluded that, regrettably, despite the best intentions of Mormons, that Mormon baptisms are not valid. And so as a result, the marriage that you had with your former spouse was purely natural. It may have been a valid marriage or it may have been an invalid marriage, but it would not have been a sacramental marriage. It would have been natural. Because it was a natural marriage, it is possible for it to be dissolved. What cannot be dissolved is a sacramental marriage between validly baptized Christians. So there is a provision. It's based on a passage in 1 Corinthians, which was, of course, written by St. Paul, where he indicates that, like, a believer is not bound to an unbelieving partner if the unbelieving partner is not willing to live with the believing partner as a Christian. And so that's given rise to a procedure known in canon law as the Pauline privilege, because 1 Corinthians was written by St. Paul. And because your marriage was one where it was purely natural and thus can be dissolved by something other than death, if you were to be baptized as a Catholic and your former spouse has no interest in being married, that marriage could be dissolved. And so the Pauline privilege is one option that is open in your situation. So that's a possibility. Another possibility is that even though you attempted marriage with your former spouse, that it may not have actually come into existence. There are various things that can go wrong that could prevent two parties who are attempting marriage from actually contracting a marriage. And so the marriage as a result could be null. And if that's the case, then the church has a procedure for investigating that as well. It's what's known as the annulment process. So the church would need to look into your former marriage with your first spouse and ask questions and then discern, was there anything at the time this marriage was contracted that would have kept it from coming into existence? And if the answer to that is yes, then the marriage was null. And that means you're free to marry your current fiancé. So there are basically, in your case, there are basically two options to be possibly pursued. One of them is the Pauline privilege, and the other is the annulment process. And oftentimes they'll do the annulment process first, but the Pauline privilege is also a possibility. So I would suggest when you discern that you think you want to become Catholic, when you're fairly certain about that, contact your local parish and explain the situation and say that you're interested in pursuing the annulment process and or the Pauline privilege.
Okay, Max.
Okay, yeah, that's incredibly helpful. Thank you.
All right. God bless you, brother. Thank you. If we can be of assistance, call again. We look forward to talking with you. Now, here's an old friend, Annie in Long Island, New York, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Hi again, Annie.
Hi, I love you guys. Oh, I'm so grateful. I'm Catholic now 4 months.
Oh, I know. Congratulations.
90 years, and I just became Catholic 4 months ago.
Well, praise God, Annie.
Okay, I have kind of like two questions. You mentioned, did I misunderstand you when you said something about not to watch TV? Because I watch Catholic stations.
No, we were joking around with another caller. So no, we weren't saying don't watch television, and especially we weren't saying don't watch Catholic television. It was just good. A joke.
Oh, all right, good. Because I enjoy Journey Home. That was a big thing to see.
Cool.
But becoming Catholic.
Marcus Grodi. Yep,
wonderful. And, of course, Catholic Answers. Okay, and the other one is yoga. Now, the fellow you were talking to said he does it alone, and he doesn't do anything religious. But I'm praying that my daughter comes out of yoga because she teaches yoga. She kind of left the faith. I don't think down deep she didn't, but she, in yoga, they have movements where you're folding your hands like you're praying. And I don't think that's wise, you know, to do. But I don't know exactly what you told the fellow there.
Well, yeah, so I asked him, was he invoking any spirits in his practice of these exercises? And he said no. And I asked him, was he trying to move spiritual energy around? And he said no. And I asked him, are you doing anything religious here? Are you trying to get some spiritual benefit by doing this? And he said no. So he wasn't doing anything religious, because you gotta invoke the spiritual, whether it's spirits or energy or spiritual benefits or something, in order to be doing something religious. And he wasn't doing any of those things. Now, you will hear some people try to claim, I think this may be where you're, what's at the origin of your question, although you could tell me if I'm wrong. I have heard some people say, oh, well, when you make these yoga postures, it's like a posture that's dedicated to some Hindu deity, let's say Vishnu. And so you're making the Vishnu posture, and you shouldn't be doing that as a Christian. Well, postures mean what people interpret them to mean. Postures are symbolic. Psychelet, if I raise my hand at an angle and place it above my my eyebrow, what is that posture I'm doing?
Well, I believe you are, because you're in my presence, saluting a superior officer.
Well, at least I'm saluting.
Oh, okay. That's interpretation on that.
That's well, because you're not my superior officer. but you could read that as I'm saluting, or you could read that as I'm scratching my forehead.
Oh, yeah, right.
And so so postures have the meaning that we give them. And the answer doesn't have to be the same for everybody, because just like languages are different. The word I'm going to blank on one, but you know, you can have a single sound that means something in one language, and it may mean something completely different in another language. Oh, I got one. Okay, so for example, the word tick. Okay, so what does tick mean in English?
It's like that little thing that bites you and it sticks in your skin.
Yeah. So a tick in English, that's one of the meanings. It's an insect. But in other languages, tick is the word for finger.
Oh.
And so, in fact, there's an argument in linguistics, at least among some linguists, that that tick may be the word for finger in proto-human, the original human language, based on its appearance with that meaning in other languages. So words are sound symbols that can mean completely different things. And it depends on how you're using it. If I am, you know, wiggling my fingers and going tick, 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 well, okay, I'm using it to mean fingers. But if I said I just got bit by a tick, I don't mean I was bit by a finger. I mean I was bit by the insect known as a tick. And in the same way, body postures have symbolic value. If I'm saluting, or if I'm flipping someone the bird, which I never do, or, you know, if I put my hands together momentarily when I'm clapping or in prayer or something else, there's all kinds of different meanings that they can have, and which one it has at the moment is the one I, the symbol user, am giving to it. So even if I do something that is physically identical to the Vishnu posture, let's say there is such a thing as a Vishnu posture, that doesn't mean it's a Vishnu posture to me. If I'm not using it to honor Vishnu, it's not that. If I'm just doing an exercise with it and I happen to stretch into a particular position, it's just an exercise posture because that's all I'm using it as. And so we shouldn't be superstitious and think that just because someone else used a posture to mean something, we can't use it in a different way. Just like we shouldn't be superstitious that just because someone in another language used a sound one way to mean one concept, that it's forever tainted and we can't use the same sound to mean something completely different in English.
Annie, I'm going to leave it there because I got to go to the break, but we always love to hear from you. Hope we'll hear from you again soon. We've got to take this break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
Are you prepared to vote?
Citizens have a co-responsibility for society. This duty especially obliges those in a democracy who must elect representatives to run the state on their behalf.
Learn more so you're prepared when you vote this November. Visit EWTN.com/vote for everything Catholic voters need to know before picking up a ballot.
Back. Catholic Answers Live, Open Forum, Jimmy Akin, our guest, and on the line is Ryan in California watching on YouTube. Ryan, thanks for being here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello. So my question is about two Bible verses, one in 1 Corinthians and one in 2 Maccabees, mm-hmm. and these are about purgatory. And
I guessed based on the citation of those two books together.
Yeah, so I haven't converted to go. Mm-hmm. Catholicism, but I was looking at those verses, and I don't really see purgatory in them. I was looking at 2 Maccabees, and they're talking about praying for the dead, but I often pray mm-hmm. for the dead simply, you know, to wish that in their life they didn't do anything that would have led them to damnation. Mm-hmm. And in the book of Corinthians, it talks about, you know, their works being burned up, but not them. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm thinking maybe this is the things that they did on earth, like the treasures they built. Those don't really matter. What matters is what's in heaven. But I don't really see purgatory in these, so I was wondering if you could clear up those concerns.
Yeah, sure. So purgatory is a post-biblical theological concept, and it is, you know, it's like the Trinity, which is also a post-biblical theological concept. It's based on principles that are articulated in Scripture, but it involves taking these principles and kind of putting them together to build up a complete picture of what purgatory is like, just like building up a complete understanding of what the Trinity is like. So we, just like we don't have a single verse in the New Testament that says there is one God who is three persons in one being, we don't have a single verse in the Old or the New Testament that says purgatory is the state of purification that occurs after death for those who die in God's friendship and that can be assisted by the actions of the living. But that's the essence of what purgatory is, and we see aspects of that understanding reflected in Scripture. We see, for example, in 2 Maccabees that they're praying for the dead soldiers who committed, they died fighting for God, And the author of Second Maccabees identifies them as individuals who fell asleep in righteousness. So despite the sin that led to their death, they fundamentally were righteous people. They died in they weren't perfect, but they died in God's friendship, and they have some continuing effects of some kind. We're not told what, but it's understood that they have some continuing effects from their sins that can be assisted by the prayers of the living. They also take up, Judah Maccabee and his men also take up a collection so that they can purchase a sacrifice to be given at the temple in Jerusalem, which is the Old Testament equivalent of having Mass said for someone, Mass being the Christian sacrifice. And so we see that the actions of the living can in some way assist the deceased who have some kind of lingering effects from the sins in life they committed in life, even though they died in God's friendship. So it doesn't articulate specifically the idea of purification, but we're really close to purgatory just based on those principles, because purgatory is the state of purification for those who have died in God's friendship from whatever lingering consequences of sin there may be, and it can be helped by the assistance of the living. We're basically there with, I mean, it doesn't use the language, but with Second Maccabees, it basically lays that concept out on the table. And it's something that Jews today continue to understand. It's always been understood in the last 2,000 years of Jewish history, 2,000 plus years of Jewish history, that, yeah, you pray for your departed loved ones, and just like they did in Second Maccabees, and that is still done today. It's not praying across time. I'm really impressed, Ryan, that you do pray across time, because I think that's perfectly legitimate. And, you know, pray, Father, please have helped this person back in their life so that they die in your friendship. That's praying across time. I think that's perfectly possible. I think it's very good to do. I do that myself all the time. And I devoted an episode of Mysterious World to time travel prayer. If you want to hear more about that, you can check that out. But in Jewish prayer and in the Maccabean prayer here, they're not praying, Lord, please help them not have done something back in life. They're acknowledging that these soldiers did something back in life. Namely, they were wearing these superstitious charms that resulted in their death. And so they're praying for the after effects of that sin. So they're not praying, please help them back when they were still alive. They're praying, please help them now with the lingering effects of that sin. In terms of 1 Corinthians 3, so St. Paul is giving an analogy in which he says we're all going to stand before the judgment of Christ and our works will be tested by fire. So you're right. It is, in a sense, I mean, this is a metaphor, but our works, because they're not physical objects, they can't literally be tested by fire. But it is our works that are being tested. But how does that happen? Well, St. Paul, since we're talking about non-physical objects, I mean, the works themselves can't literally be tested by fire. Works as are abstract things that can't feel. Works do not have consciousness. If I go down to a soup kitchen and help out poor people for 2 hours, that act does not have consciousness. It can't feel fire. But fire is an experiential image. I mean, the reason Scripture uses fire as an image of judgment is to convey the experience of being judged. And so even though Paul says the works are what's being tested, there's a good likelihood here that what he means is we are going to be judged with something that at least is analogous to fire, you know, like some kind of spiritual judgment on the basis of our works. What he then says is our works, some of them are, if they've been poorly constructed, if they're of inferior quality, they're going to be burned up. But whatever remains, we'll receive a reward for. So he says if a man builds with gold, silver, or precious stones, it will remain and the man will receive a reward in heaven. Well, obviously, there's an experiential component to that. You know, if you get a reward in heaven, that's great. That feels wonderful. You got a heavenly reward. Awesome. On the other hand, he says that if all of our works are worthless and they all burn up, then the man will suffer loss. And suffering loss is, again, it's an experience and it doesn't feel good. He even says that the man who for whom all of his works are burned up will be saved. So we know he died in God's friendship. He's not one of the damned. He will be saved. But as Paul says, as one escaping through flames. Now, the image that Paul has been building here is like you're building a house or a temple with because you're building on the foundation of Christ. The temple metaphor is probably what's in his mind. You're building a metaphorical temple for Christ with your works. And so if you built out of straw and your metaphorical temple catches fire and in the judgment and you escape through the flames, that's like running out of a wooden or straw temple that's crashing down around you. That ain't fun. I'm tempted to say, take it from one who knows, but I've never actually escaped from a burning temple. In any event, it's not a fun experience. And so that shows that our actions in this life can have consequences that in the afterlife will have a negative effect. We can suffer loss. It can feel like you're running out of a flaming temple to escape the judgment of what happened with due to your bad actions in life, and you're still going to be saved. So this also can be, and also because fire is a common spiritual image or a common biblical image of purification. You know, like we read about being tested in the refiner's fire because they would use fire to like refine metals like gold and silver and iron and stuff. Fire is a very common biblical image of purification. So here in 1 Corinthians, we see our actions in this life, our negative actions in this life, having a continuing effect in the afterlife, even for the saved. But this is apparently a temporary negative effect, so it seems to be one that passes because you escape, you know, you get out through the flames. And we're using a common biblical image of purification. So this all, again, I would say supports aspects of the doctrine of purgatory, even though it doesn't articulate the whole thing in one place. Does that help, Ryan?
Hang on, Ryan. I got to put you back on here. Go ahead. Does that help you, Ryan?
It does. The only thing about Second Maccabees is my understanding was that the only afterlife they believed in at that time period was Abraham's bosom. So how would they have known about the existence of heaven, hell, or purgatory as Christians understand them today?
Well, they wouldn't have necessarily. So I don't have any basis for saying they knew about Abraham's bosom in particular. Abraham's bosom is a concept that's introduced by Jesus in the Gospel of Luke. The idea that of the afterlife that is predominant in the Old Testament is Sheol, which was the place of the dead. And then there was also, by the time of the Maccabees, there was also an awareness that in the future there's going to be a resurrection. And in fact, the author of Second Maccabees comments on that. He says that Judah Maccabee was, you know, not expecting these guys to be worm food. He's expecting them to have a future resurrection, and he's praying that they be freed from the consequences of their sins. He may or may not have understood the afterlife exactly the way we do because, you know, he was living at an earlier stage of progressive revelation. He didn't have all the information about the afterlife that we do, but he did have enough information about the afterlife that he realized there could be lingering effects of sin that follow you into the afterlife, and that obviously that wouldn't be pleasant, whatever those effects are, but they can be assisted by the actions of the living in praying for them and offering sacrifice for them.
Thank you, Ryan. Thanks, everybody else who called. If you're on the line and we haven't gotten to you tomorrow, we'll start with Ask a Priest first hour, so maybe hang on and ask Father Sam that question tomorrow. Jimmy Akin has been our guest. Jimmy, thank you very much. I really enjoyed the 2 hours.
Likewise. My pleasure, Cy Kellett.
And we'll look forward to the new episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. We're in the 200s now, right?
Oh, yeah. We're coming up. We just did 230, I think.
230. 230 episodes available. So if you've never caught Jimmy Agee's Mysterious World, you got a world of fun in front of you. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.